This is September 7th, 2014, and today I'm going to read and comment on an article that appeared in the appeared in Tricycle Magazine, fall 2014. That's probably the current issue of Tricycle Magazine. It's called White Trash Buddhist. That's the title. This is going to be one of those Tay shows that talks more about focuses more on Sangha than Buddha and Dharma. These are the three treasures, the three jewels: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In Zen, Buddha really means Buddha nature. Dharma is the teaching, the sutras and the words of the masters, and Sangha is the community of people who are part of all this. You could say that Dharma, the word Dharma, it's one of these Sanskrit words that has multiple meanings or ways of understanding it. In the broadest sense, there's nothing outside the Dharma. A born-again Christian is whatever his or her practice may be, is part of the Dharma, capital D, reality, truth, things as they are. What ISIS is doing in Iraq and Syria is not outside the Dharma. But when we understand Dharma as the Buddha's teaching, then it's a different meaning. And from that perspective, we could say that there are these two aspects to it, three aspects: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And here, what caught me with this article was how much it speaks to Americans' practice, Dharma practice, in that it's American Zen Buddhist practice so far has been overwhelmingly a lay practice, and that's what the author here addresses and the issues that he's facing. His name is Brent Oliver. Lives in Lexington, Kentucky. But again, he gave it this provocative title, White Trash Buddhist, and then the subtitle, Do You Have to Break the Bank to Break into the Upper Middle Way? A Kentucky native shows us what practice looks like on minimum wage. I'll just wade into this. I am forever in debt to the handful of teachers, writers, and thinkers who introduced me to Buddhist practice, who provide constant inspiration and continue to shape my knowledge of this path. Actually, I'm just forever in debt. Every time I get in my 12-year-old car and rattle away to the nearest retreat center, I'm reminded that I'm a poor white trash Buddhist. It's a good thing none of those luminaries will ever try to collect, since I can't even afford the practice as it is. That's a shame, because the Dharma saved my life. Once a miserable creature, I was crushed by depression and pursuing self-destruction with a level of dedication that would have made even Fight Club's Tyler Durden cringe. Fight Club is a movie that I guess I haven't seen it, but it seems to show someone who does cage fighting. And when I came across a little book on Buddhism, I scoffed. It wasn't an ordinary scoff either. It was the abrasive, well-practiced derision of the outspoken skeptic. I bought the book because I was skeptical of even my own mockery. See, there's a sign of promise in this guy, that he even had the critical faculties to question his own mockery, his own disparaging. It shows a self-reflective quality, that a not trusting the stuff of one's mind, but look, trying to see beyond it. Just a few chapters in, I understood that I'd always been a Buddhist. After the briefest descriptions of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, I felt their truths ring in my bones. Let me pause and mention these three. I've often mentioned these in Teisho, but for those who haven't heard them or need a review, anicca is the early Buddhist word. I don't know if it's Sanskrit or Pali, but anicca means impermanence. Dukkha means suffering or a sense of dissatisfaction with the world and oneself. And anatta means no self. No, nothing has any permanent, substantial self nature. So these are the three, often called the three characteristics of existence. These three, if someone asked you what is Buddha's teaching, well, this would be one way to answer. It's based on teaching of these three aspects, features, characteristics of existence: impermanence, suffering or dissatisfaction, and no self. I felt their truths ring in my bones. These teachings didn't just make sense. They described an innate philosophy I'd always possessed but couldn't articulate. Yeah, it's a fortunate person who comes to a Dharma center and feels that kind of resonance with a teaching. But I suspect many of us did who came here have a sense of that, okay, this is it, finally. There's nothing about God in these three characteristics of existence. In fact, the third one, no self, is a denial of any kind of permanent creator God. It just, for those of us who are suited to the Dharma, it speaks volumes. This was 1998, before I had that newfangled internet, so my search for a Dharma group was confined to the listings in the back of Tricycle. I practiced as well as I could on my own, which was not very diligently. When I found a local Shambhala center — Shambhala is a big sangha, national sangha of Tibetan Buddhist sangha. And that's the name of it. When I found a local Shambhala center, I signed right the hell up. I was ecstatic. Buddhism in my town. I was going to fling myself at the dusty brown feet of an old Tibetan master post haste. But when I showed up at the center, I made a baffling discovery. It was infested with upper middle class white people. I glanced around furtively for the maroon-robed saint I was sure must be nearby, but found no such person. I considered slowly backing out of the room and slinking away, but it seemed rude. So I stayed for 5 years. I never officially joined because I couldn't pay. The membership fees were beyond my means. Thanks to some kind administrators, I was able to attend several programs. I don't know what he means by that. I even managed to live at one of Shambhala's retreat centers in Vermont for 2 months. Let me pause here and point out what I feel are important distinctions in this article. I never officially joined because I couldn't pay. I hope you all know that here at the Rochester Zen Center, not paying will not bar you from being a member of the Zen Center. All right, we'd ask that there's some little, at least tiny little donation you make, just because it's not healthy to have no mutuality at all, no exchange. But not being able to pay dues is not a reason you'll ever have to forego membership in the center. It's one of several points I want to use this Taisho to make. So I managed to live at one of their retreat centers in Vermont for 2 months. There were two main groups of dedicated practitioners at the center. You had your older, upper-middle-class folks with professions, vacation time, and plenty of disposable income. Then you had your young people, generally of the same class, with no real jobs, who were content to live there in temporary poverty as long as the accommodations came with a spiritual teacher, vegetarian meals, and an honest shot at enlightenment. I think this is, as he describes it here, these two groups of practitioners is not unlike what we see here in Rochester. The way the language we usually use is those who are on staff, residential training, and those who aren't. Although there are plenty of people, plenty of non-residents who are members who would not be considered upper middle class with vacation time and plenty of disposable income. And that's what we're going to get into as we go on. The Shambhala Center was staffed by the latter, that is, the young people who could accept temporary poverty, was staffed by the latter, that's what we call our staff, our residents, and attended by the former, that's those who are not staff, who attend sittings and other events. So far, this mirrors, to some extent, what we have here. I was on the work-study crew, I think he means a resident, one of the residents, which meant laboring in the kitchen in exchange for room, board, and access to a large room full of cushions. I think he does have a future as a writer. He's pretty wry. I was 27 and had a job out in the world waiting tables that was quite real but not at all professional. Let me just say here, you note that he's living there at the center, but has a job as a waiter. And that's something we've considered always from time to time at the center is whether we could have people living here, residents, who didn't work here full time. And other than one or two brief exceptions throughout our history, we've felt that there were enough people who wanted to live here and work here full time that we didn't have additional rooms to accommodate serious people who felt they needed to work on the outside. This is not a closed door. Someday, who knows? It would be a lot more doable at Chapin Mill, where we have so many rooms. There, space is not a problem, except during rental retreats, which could complicate things a little bit. But in any case, there's a difference that we have here, a difference from some other Dharma centers. Zen, Tibetan, or Vipassana centers is so far, we just have to have people living here who work full time. I said I had a job waiting tables that was quite real, but not at all professional. And that's where I got tangled up. Waiting tables, like other low-paying jobs, isn't a gig with many benefits. I had health insurance, which is almost unheard of in the industry, but the perks ended there. No sick days, personal time, or paid vacation. Taking time off threw my bank account into convulsions. I would never have been able to put my job on hold for 2 months had I not lucked into an unexpected financial windfall. My grandmother, in a moment of feverish generosity, gave me some cash for no reason other than that I looked like I could use it. With my savings thus bolstered, I had my first opportunity to seriously commit to practice. Notice the implication there is that serious practice has to be residential. And this is one of quite a few points we can take issue with that. It's one form of serious practice and is definitely has its advantages over trying to practice out in the world, but it's has disadvantages too. So he's still talking about this two-month retreat he came up with the money to attend. Once settled at the retreat center, however, I was disconcerted to find I didn't really belong to either dominant demographic. Most of my fellow work-study staff had quit forgettable jobs to live in a tent behind the main building and devote themselves to Vajrayana practice. I couldn't do that. Buddhism had saved my life, but it hadn't transformed me into a Dharma bum. Some of these kids had traded financial stability and careers, at least in the short term, to wander wherever the teachings led. Most either had a college degree, familial connections, or a padded curriculum vitae to fall back on. I got to know several self-identified Dharma brats who grew up in convert Buddhist households. Convert Buddhist is a term that's come into currency to mean those who didn't grow up in a Buddhist family. So you grow up in a Protestant or Catholic or Jewish or other family, and you converted. You became a Buddhist. Dharma brats who grew up in convert Buddhist households with the wherewithal to support their spiritual escapades. My own parents were blue-collar folks, Protestants at that, who had built a successful business by working like mules. They saw my Buddhist practice as an Eastern oddity that should take a back seat to figuring out an honest career, and I'd inherited enough of their no-nonsense ethic to at least partially agree. I think of my mother after I'd been here for a few years, and I was talking about being ordained, hearing my mother say, "All right, this is a big," she'd come a long way when she said this, "All right, Zen is okay as an avocation, but what about a vocation?" I was drawn to Buddhism because of its practicality in daily life. I didn't want to withdraw from the world. I didn't want to withdraw from the world. We have here in American Buddhism, we have what historically could be seen as uncharted waters that we're moving through. Historically, in other words, for most of the 2,500-year history of Buddhism, to be serious about the Dharma practice meant you became ordained. Just that. If you were serious enough, you renounced worldly careers and became a monk or a nun. Done. Lifelong vows. Not just dropping out of a career path to be in residential training for a while, but that was it. You had a choice, lay or ordained, monastic, that is. What is unique about the Western Buddhism, not just American, but I think European, is that now most people who practice and practice seriously try to do both. They, just speaking now for the Zen Center, a lot of people with careers who want to stay on their chosen career have to find a way to enter the monastic style of practice in the form of sesshins. A week here, one week a year, maybe 2 weeks a year, maybe a shorter sesshin, or as coming to an all-day sitting, which is what we're having today. You stay in your career and you just have spurts of residential practice where you just bear down and work in silence and do a lot of sitting. And this seems to be the predominant model, not just in Rochester, but throughout the West. A lot of people can't find the free time to even go to one sesshin a year. Or they just also possibly just choose to use that free time for something else. And that's what ultimately this all comes down to, is choice. How do we choose to spend whatever free time we may have? But here, we'll get back to that, but here, this is this Brent Oliver is in a particular predicament because he doesn't have free time, he says. And there are others in our own Sangha who have no vacation time. We're the only, I keep hearing this here and there on NPR and other places, we're the only industrial advanced country, so-called advanced, where that has no paid vacation time for everyone, mandated by law. So I was drawn to Buddhism because of its practicality in daily life. Daily life, what he means. I mean, living at a Dharma center is also daily life. Again, you see these false distinctions that insinuate that daily life is only outside a Dharma center. I was drawn to Buddhism because of practicality in daily life. I didn't want to withdraw from the world. And I definitely wasn't one of the well-heeled professionals parking an Acura in the gravel lot for a pricey 30-day retreat. I don't hear very much about 30-day retreats in Zen Buddhism, but in Vipassana Buddhism and maybe Vajrayana, they have these kinds of retreats. They're nothing like the rigor of I've heard. Nothing. They don't have the rigor of our sesshins, but they are a way to withdraw from one's family and career for an extended period of time. My wife has been to Vipassana retreats at IMS, Insight Meditation Society, and for 7 to 9 days, and I've heard her marvel at people who could afford to do that for 30 days or 60 days, but there are those people. So again, he's referring to these well-heeled professionals who can afford a 30-day retreat. These were the parents of the future staff, work-study staff. Middle-class Buddhists tend to produce more middle-class Buddhists, which is great, but I wasn't one of them. I could only afford a little bit of the Dharma for a little while. Okay. A little bit of the Dharma. Okay, let's not conflate the Dharma with retreats. The whole point in Zen practice, and maybe Buddhist practice generally, is to make your life your practice. To stop dividing time into when I'm at the Zen center and when I'm at home or at work. The whole point is to integrate your practice into your whole day. Now, we all know how hard that is. We know how hard it is to be free of thoughts in work and with family. We know how hard it is to be free of thoughts in activity, free of thoughts anywhere but while sitting. But just because it's hard doesn't mean it's unattainable. It's something to work toward ceaselessly. This is within our reach. The sitting, the daily sitting, is what makes it more and more possible to keep the mind free of thoughts all the time. But let's not throw that overboard and see that as something beyond our ability. This is what we can all work toward endlessly. So he could afford just as much Dharma as a wealthy person by paying attention, being aware and alert, and not letting the mind flee into the past or the future, but just being completely present, whatever he's doing. There it is. That's the whole Dharma. Nothing lacking. Nothing missing. But let's take him in his terms, just to follow this through, because it's valid enough to talk about this. He couldn't afford to go to retreats. That's what he's saying. And let me also mention here that we have, for people who can't afford to go to sesshins, we have what we call the Abbot's Fund, which is it's a scholarship fund where people who have the means donate money to the Abbot's Fund to help people who couldn't otherwise go to sesshin, to help them financially pay for it. These are the people with the well-heeled professionals parking an Acura in the parking lot who we can be grateful to, who will be generous enough to donate to the Abbot's Fund and help those who couldn't otherwise pay for sesshin or other residential training. I've learned over the years that we've had the Abbot's Fund, which is maybe 20 years, 15 or 20 years, that there are people who are reluctant. They hate to ask for help from the Abbot's Fund. And I hate to think that they're not going to sesshin because they don't want to ask for help from the Abbot's Fund. We've tried to hammer this home in our mailings, that it's there. Over and over again, we tell people the Abbot's Fund is available to help you. And short of begging people to take the Abbot's Fund, there's not much more we can do. And I've come to accept that if people are too proud, let's call it what it is, if you're too proud or slash ashamed, two sides of the same thing, if you're too ashamed to ask for help, then you're not, you don't want badly enough to go to sesshin. And I say this just as the sesshin fees have been hiked $5 a day It's important to remember this. So we discuss this at length in our trustees meeting, trustees and officers, and we had great reluctance to raise Sesshin fees at all, even $5 a day. But we reminded one another that people do have recourse to the Abbot's Fund, and that our Sesshin fees until now have been below the average. It's a big source of income, one of our three largest sources of income, first being membership dues and also just investments, interest on investments. Okay, after my two-month immersion in the world of Shambhala, I decided to move on. I'd never gotten comfortable with its mixture of middle-aged affluence and youthful nonchalance. I stepped into the realm of Zen looking for some no-bullshit clarity, but the same class issues were lurking in this new austerity. Here, too, retreats and programs were cost-prohibitive to someone in a rickety tax bracket like mine. I worked mostly nights, so it was hard enough to get off for group zazen on Wednesday evenings, and that was free. Excuse me, I just, you know, I missed this the first time I read it yesterday, but the shift, after the 2 months in the Tibetan Buddhist practice, he shifted into Zen. So now we're into Zen practice. I worked mostly nights, so it was hard enough to get off for group zazen on Wednesday evenings, and that was free. Finances weren't the only burden either. It can be rough trying to connect with a sangha when your schedule deviates from the 9-to-5 Monday through Friday grind, the established upper-middle-class routine. During my affiliation with the Zen group, I was one of only a few who didn't have a serious connection to the larger sangha. I missed casual gatherings, potlucks, doksan, formal ceremonies, and weekend programs because I had no cash and lived outside the 40-hour work week. I never for a second felt unwelcome, but I also knew that I didn't fit the dynamic. I've heard from plenty of people in our sangha who have the same painful predicament, whose work doesn't mesh, whose work hours don't mesh with our schedule. And I feel real sympathy for these people, some of them very serious about practice, who just can't get here for the morning or evening sittings, they say. And sure, sometimes it's true. I don't know what to do about that. I mean, we've told people we have on most days we have a half hour noon sitting that some of the residents participate in. Not all of them, but some of them, and people are always welcome to come then. And besides that, you can come just about any time and use the zendo. Any time it's not being cleaned or there's some rehearsal or something happening in the zendo, which is 99% of the time, the zendo is sitting here open, available to people around the clock, including at night. Once you become a member and you have access to the back door of the center, you come in the middle of the night and sit, if that works better for your schedule. But still, it's painful. It's painful to me as a teacher to hear from people who are just trying to make ends meet and have jobs where they can't participate in some of these important activities. I'm open to suggestions. I scheduled the occasional Saturday morning doksans to try to help people be available to people who can't come on the weekdays. Maybe I can do more in that regard. Maybe in the middle of one day a week, one weekday a week, I can offer Doksan. I don't know if anyone has any, wants to give me any input on this, I'm all ears. Now, I have to say, and I'm sure some of you have picked up on this, that this guy seems to have a need to feel alienated. He needs to somehow feel apart from others. However it is that he is different in his work and his financial situation, it may be true enough, but he's certainly focusing on it a lot. There's a lot of I, me, and my in this article. Just had to say that. Okay, he's a writer. He's trying to make a living as a writer, and so this is his angle. You've got to have an angle when you're writing an article, and I think it's a very important, many important points he's making, which is why I like this article so much. But you know, there's always another side to things, and here, the other side is he doesn't have to focus so much on his own troubles. One of the things I've always felt about this American brand of Zen is that for the first time in history, we Americans expect the Dharma to accommodate itself to us. Historically, in Asian countries, you expect to accommodate yourself to the Dharma, to the structure, to the way things have been established. But with us Americans, we want it all. We know this phrase, the want it all. It's usually used in reference to women wanting to have children and gratifying work and well-paying jobs and all. The question is, how realistic is it to have it all? How realistic is it to not have to make some sacrifices, some choices, and set priorities about what you want? This is why we have, one reason we have a residential training program, is for people, even without much money, people who are committed enough, dedicated enough to practice with others, there's a way to do that. When you start off in residential training, you have to cover your expenses. We don't put people on the payroll until they've been here for a while. But, you know, is that so much to ask that someone find a way, make save some money enough to, you know, come here and where by the way, you have room and board covered, even if you don't, you're not receiving any little salary. And then if you stick it out long enough and you show that you're serious enough, then we have compensation. It's not a lot, but it's enough for a place where you have room and board covered and a lot of other things. So I would say to this, what is it you want? Now, it's complicated because we all have, well, not all, but many of us have certain talents, certain affinities with work, certain kinds of work that we need to pursue. We're called to certain kinds of work and not other kinds of work. We feel the need, if we're a writer, to write, to have that, to be able to do that full time. If we're a teacher, school teacher, feel the need to teach others, we got to pursue that as a career. We have to do that. If you're a musician, you have to. You can't do it halfway. You've got to do it all the way. I remember talking to one of our Sangha musicians from, I don't know, 35 years ago, a violinist, who said, my koan seems to be am I a violinist practicing the Dharma, or am I a Dharma practitioner doing the violin? These are painful dilemmas that we face in this American lay Buddhist practice. And who has the answer? Something has to give. A lot of you will just muddle through somehow, find a way to get to Sesshin occasionally, or sittings at least. But it's hard. It's certainly is hard. And that's why I like this article so much, is because he's articulating what many of you have had to face. And even I would say, just to some extent, I knew from the time I stepped in the Zen Center that I wanted to do this full time. And I, at first, the first couple of years, they didn't have room here. All we had was 7 AP. We didn't have 5 AP. Certainly didn't have Chapin Mill. And so we're very limited in the number of people who could be accommodated here. And there came a point when Roshi Kapil got one of his periodic exasperations with staff and all of the problems of people living together and getting and pulling each other's hair and getting into all kinds of... And he just decided, okay, I'm just going to have 3 people on staff. So I was one of the ones who didn't make the cut. I had no money at all. What was I going to do? I knew that I wanted to do this full time. That no career other than this spoke to me. Everything was pale to me compared to this. And then a bodhisattva stepped forward, a fellow staff member, Zenson Gifford, who had made the cut. He was one of the 3 or 4 who was allowed to stay on staff and get $10 a month of compensation, gave me a chunk of money that enabled me to stay on staff. And then Roshi realized after a few weeks that having a staff of 3 people just wasn't adequate. And then I got a reprieve. I got back on. To resume, with all that in mind, I had gone to trade school to get licensed as a massage therapist. I thought it might let me set my own hours and claw my way up out of the restaurant trade. Even though the cost of a trade school was much cheaper than a college degree, I racked up some intimidating debt. When you're broke, debt is the easiest thing to accumulate. Because it seems like the only road to a better life. I was struggling as a server, and the only way to acquire new skills that might let me rise above my station was to pay for them. It's counterintuitive, but it's the new American way. Spend money you don't have to bet on a well-paid future. This is so common now. Probably everyone knows this. It's just terrible, the depth of yes, poverty generally, and student debt. People get out of college. They're just saddled with often terrible debt, and then on top of it, many of them can't even get a job other than a low paying job. It's a symptom about a sick society we are, that this is so pervasive. He goes on, my gamble didn't pay off. I unknowingly walked right into another profession chock full of no benefits. 0 sick days, 0 vacation time, and every hour I spent away from the clinic was an hour I didn't get paid. It seemed as if my practice would never mature. Okay, there again, just to make this point, my practice would never mature. As hard as it is, you've got to find your practice right in that bind of debt. And struggling to make ends meet. That's the maturation. Parents know this, struggling with taking care of kids and not going to Sesshin for 5 or 10 years. You've got to make that your practice. Practice is not just retreats. I continued to sit at home and learn mainly from books and the internet. Like many working class Americans, I found that my lack of a traditional college education narrowed my employment opportunities, and education had become so ludicrously expensive that it was far out of reach. I wasn't alone in my dinky little job. In 2012, the National Employment Law Project found that 58% of jobs created since the recession ended were low wage, paying less than $13.83 an hour. 58%, less than $13.83 an hour. On the whole, poverty level jobs are far outpacing the general economy's recovery. So my practice suffered. I kept massaging, but got a second job waiting tables. It wasn't even easy to score that job, because lowly as it was, a lot of people needed it. Still, the debt rose. My Zazen felt shaky without the guidance of a teacher, and I was becoming disillusioned with Zen on the whole. I was no good at striving without striving, or thinking non-thinking. These are phrases that you hear more. The second one is a phrase you hear more at other centers than here. Thinking, non-thinking. I don't like that at all, because it's not thinking. Even calling it even if you say thinking, non-thinking, still thinking is misleading. It's not thinking. I think it probably refers to shikantaza, which has nothing to do with thinking. Even thinking, non-thinking. But the striving without striving, yeah, that's something we've often said here. That's a whole other topic. Again, this phrase, my Zazen felt shaky without the guidance of a teacher. Tell me, for those of you who can't access me, tell me how I can help. And then it shifted again to Theravadan Buddhism. He's looking for a Vipassana or Theravada Dharma Center. He said, if I wanted to go to a costly retreat, I'd have to travel, which added another expense to the menacing pile of debt. My internet searches for nearby centers kept widening. As the concentric circles spread out, I could practically hear my battered credit cards sighing at the prospect of plane tickets or car repair bills. My injuries couldn't absorb another insult. Then he says, I'm not bitter about the retreat system in America. There's no doubt that retreat is the best way to solidify and deepen one's practice. And of course, it can't happen for free, because centers have to pay rent, bills, and teachers. I get that. People like me are just lost along the way. We don't feel the overwhelming urge to simply leave the world behind and go live in a temple. Well, you don't have to. Yet we don't have enough money or the right kind of jobs to focus our practice in a serious formal setting. To be sure, there are options that help us along. A work study and financial aid are two big ones. I've utilized both before and I will again. I have no choice, but it's still painful. For the first Vipassana retreat I attended, I received a scholarship that covered half of the fee. At the end of the day and a half program, we heard the usual talk on dana. Dana means giving or generosity. This is how many Vipassana retreats work, is you're asked to offer dana to the teacher at the end of the retreat. You know, that's you've just gone through a retreat and you're hit up for money. That's like shooting fish in a barrel, and it's something we've really tried to avoid. It's people are so susceptible to such pleas, and luckily, when I give retreats, I don't ask for any dana because the sangha is supporting me here on staff. I manage, but in Vipassana is a different system. They have teachers coming and going. They're not on any payroll, and so they understandably ask for people to chip in at the end of the retreat. And he says it's important. These were local teachers with day jobs, not international Dharma celebrities with book deals and podcasts. Our donations would compensate them for their time. But my face was hot and my hands shook as I pulled out the only tenant of my wallet to slip in the envelope. A $5 bill was what I had to contribute to someone who had just spent 42 hours guiding my practice. And then he said, by this time I had managed to turn a lifelong passion into a vocation, writing. It's the only thing he said I ever wanted to do. I'll just skip through this a bit. The beginning of a freelance career is a delicate thing, and selling nonfiction articles wasn't something that made my lifestyle comfortable enough to start hopping off to retreats every couple of months. Luckily, writing was exactly as lucrative as my previous jobs, so I didn't have to suffer the sudden shock of fortune and leisure. I had given up massage but was forced to keep waiting tables as I struggled to attract publishers for my work. The Zen retreat I just attended was on a Saturday, and that's kind of a big deal for restaurants. I would have made more money waiting tables than the retreat cost. It was difficult. And not just because of the money that I would lose at the restaurant. I had writing deadlines to meet as well. Every word I typed had the potential to bring in new clients with new dollars to create the life I wanted, the life that could lead to the eradication of debt and grant me privileged access to upper middle class Dharma. And I'm on the upper end of the low-class Dharma student spectrum. He's really into this class mentality. My main concerns are battling debt and trying to escape the economic quagmire these crappy jobs are perpetuating. I still have health insurance, but millions don't. When a practitioner can't afford a simple checkup or mammogram, a week-long retreat is out of the question. My wife and I have no children and no elderly relatives to care for, but those who do have issues that, but those who do have issues that clearly dwarf mine. Any serious practitioner who has to cough up for child care or assisted living is in a spot so tight it squeaks, especially if they had a decent middle class gig that evaporated during the recession. You know, I can quibble with the kind of need he has to feel alienated and feel sorry for himself, but mostly I just feel real sympathy for him and others in our Sangha and other Sanghas who have to face these things. Our Sangha and the Buddhist Sangha generally is a microcosm of the larger society, the poverty that people in Sangha's face, or semi-poverty, reflects the larger ills of the terrible situation of poverty and what to do about it. It's no simple question. People may think they have simple answers. Well, you just give more money to help others who get to sesshins. Well, sure, that would be nice, but no one can mandate these things. You have to. How much does the federal government help with poverty programs? How effective are they? These are thorny issues that that we see reflected in our own Sangha. But a lot of folks who used to have reasonably comfortable lives are now saddled with problems that seem insurmountable. Where are their Dharma dreams? All right, I'm not at the end, but we have to stop here. Let me just see if there's any last point. I did want to point out what we have said in mailings at least twice, if not more times, which is that if you are saddled with huge student debt and you are committed enough to residential training, there is a program, a federal program, where after 10 years of working at a nonprofit like the Zen Center, you have the debt forgiven. The 10 years don't have to be consecutive years, but they have to accumulate into 10 years, and then you're done. So it's not just a choice between getting out of debt and practicing full time. But in the end, it's about choices. It's about recognizing that we can't have it all. Those of us who work here full time don't have other things that people non-residents have. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.